Well, hello, and welcome to today's Talky Bit. It's good to be with you. Judy wouldn't even have been aware of this. It happened very last minute, but I am in fact in Saskatoon, and more on that in a moment. But just as a bit of context for today's Talky Bit, I should say this could be a little bit messy. I've got my Kleenex handy. What I'm going to share with you today is something that I wrote on Friday night. Mom left us and set off on the next part of her journey yesterday, Saturday at 5:27 p.m. I'll say more about that as I go along. And so I am, in fact, in Saskatoon. And live streaming to you from the space that until just a few days ago would have been my mom's home. So a fraught, if you will, place, but also a place filled with lovely memories and a lot of love. So that's all to the good. This is going to be a little bit of a time capsule. I'm not sure what other language to use for it. I'm going to use present tense language for this, even though some of the things I'm going to be talking about are chronologically in the past. I wasn't sure then, and I'm not sure now how else I could have done this. And so, if it feels like you're watching a movie that has two timelines, every once in a while, just hold that thought. It's okay, but I'll try to unpack that a little bit. Time capsule is one metaphor that came to mind. Another one is that there's going to be parts of this that feel a little bit like you're peeking into my journal, perhaps. Know that I'm aware that I'm doing that, and I'm fine with that. So, I think about Talky Bit topics and details and illustrations all the time. They are always tumbling around in my head. They're often tumbling around in my heart and my emotions as well. But that said, there has to be some point in this process, at least for me. Because this isn't extemporaneous, it's considered. There has to be some point in this process where they get written down. And usually that is a time that I very deliberately put into my schedule for the week. I block out a big enough chunk of time that will be uninterrupted, that I can hopefully be creative, I can focus my energy, I can make something of the pieces. I can sit down and assemble those deliberations into something that has a shape. Some weeks, though, circumstances are not that tidy, and that block of time doesn't happen. And this has been one of those weeks. And to be clear, none of what I'm about to say is a complaint. If it's a lament, it's not that kind of a lament. It's what is. It is reality. And the reality, and this is where the timeline part might get a little strange for some of us, but the reality is that I'm writing this while I'm sitting in the palliative care wing on the fifth floor of St. Paul's Hospital in Saskatoon, late at night, and I'm listening to my mom, and I'm listening to her breathe. And sometimes it's not coming that easy to her. Sometimes it's labored. And I'm wondering, how many more of those breaths does my mom have in her? Does she have enough to get to morning? Does she have enough for another day? Enough for 2 days? We drove here today, Friday, in response to my sister Karen's message that said, in part, "Come soon." Now, all caps, communicating all the way along the drive, and I drove as I said to somebody, as fast as the law would allow, in a little bit. But you can only drive so fast. But all the way along, just hoping to get here in time for, a few more moments together. And I am delighted to say that happened. The gift of, for us as people who live farther away, the gift of one more evening together. How lovely! So grateful. Some of you have met my mom. She was our guest at the table for a talky bit just a few months ago. There is a very short list of people in my life of whom I would confidently say, I never wondered if you love me. Mom, one would be at the top of that list. So to know that our access to one another as embodied humans is forever altered, that's a hard thing. To lose that experience of an anchor in your life. Ouch, that hurts. But maybe I should say, and as huge as it is in my life to know that I have never doubted my mom's love, it's also huge to acknowledge that she showed me what it means to be pragmatic. That sometimes there are things that need to be done, and there is nothing to be gained by avoiding doing them. Dig in, work hard, rest as needed, work hard some more, repeat. That's how my mom faced the hard stuff. It's an interesting combination, love and pragmatism. It means, in my experience at least, among other things, that love isn't always warm and fuzzy. That sometimes love is so practical that it can almost seem cold or indifferent to the feelings of the moment. And yet, when love is something that we feel confident about, as I do about my mom's love for me, even those deeply practical moments are rooted in something that is mysteriously nurturing, even when that's not what the emotion of the moment is. So it's a complex thing. It's a both and thing, like a lot of the most important things in life, which, you know, in a roundabout way, surprise, side door, that was sarcasm for those of you who don't know me, in a roundabout way brings me to the topic that I mentioned in the blurb. It seems to me that we are, in this part of the world, in this moment, part of a culture that sometimes struggles to find ways to help us think about our humanness that can assist us in finding a balance, or at least living relatively well in the tension between things like love and pragmatism. There's a tension between love and pragmatism that is similar to the tension between thinking about ourselves primarily as complex individual machines versus primarily as dynamic living organisms that are part of a complex web of reality and life. I don't think it's especially difficult to find examples of how we are treated or sometimes treat or think of ourselves in mechanistic terms. I alluded to this in the blurb when I talked about feeling run down as somebody who drives some old vehicles. Maybe that metaphor is just a little too handy. Anytime that we think about or talk about ourselves primarily in terms of productivity or output or accomplishments, we're in this general terrain of thinking about ourselves in mechanistic terms as human beings. I'm not going to get into it much in the context today, but there's a whole school of thought. There's an entire system for explaining the world and our experiences of it that is built on the premise that everything that we experience can be reduced to mass and motion. The school of thought is called mechanism. No huge surprise. Here's an interesting thing, though, to me. Even though living bodies present, right from the first moments that we encounter them, properties that have no counterpart in lifeless matter, that philosophy, mechanism, aims to go beyond those appearances, so the way we experience those things, and try to explain all of that vital phenomena as physical or chemical facts. If you've ever been present for the birth of a baby, this might just seem a little bit hard to countenance. Like, why would anybody go there that far and that insistently? And so there are, you know, no surprise, competing philosophies that say that vital activities like I just talked about, can never be explained by the same laws that govern lifeless matter. And so we could go around and around that philosophical debate, and many people have, and if you want to look it up, knock yourself out. But instead of bogging down in a philosophical debate, I thought, let's see what happens if we take as our baseline idea the thought that we as human beings exist for more than utility, that we're here to do more than get things done. As with my mom's balancing act between love and pragmatism, it's not about pitting those things against one another so much as it is about seeking a balance. And that's hard to do if we're viewing ourselves exclusively, or I would say even primarily, as something akin to cogs in a machine or spokes in a wheel or moving parts of a complex mechanism. This next idea might seem a little bit like coming at it sideways, but stay with me for a moment. Let's ask the question. I invite you to ask the question. What are some of the most fundamental wants or needs that we have as human beings? Big question, I realize. Lots of possible ways to answer it. I'm going to choose some answers that fit nicely with the point that I'm trying to emphasize. Okay? So if you want to take a different, you know, tack, go for it. I'm going to suggest that two of our core wants or needs as human beings are those of being valued and being in control. To feel like no one values us is enormously painful. It's so painfully that it can easily sever relationships. It can seriously compromise our ability to face challenges, our resiliency. It can lead us quite directly down the path of despair and depression and other struggles with our mental well-being. I was having a conversation with someone recently that was moving, physically, relocating, and they were finding the upheaval of that quite distressing. And we ended up talking about how when the world around us is clearly, undeniably, not entirely within our control, ordering the things that we can is an essential aspect of caring well for our mental health. Being valued and being in control are big, powerful needs. And in this part of the world, at this moment in history, one of the main ways that our society has shown us how to understand ourselves or experience ourselves as valuable and in control is to be productive. The culture has linked those things strongly together. So when something assails our ability to be productive, we can pretty easily feel like we're less worthy or like our life is spinning out of control, like something is sort of cosmically wrong. Lots of ways we could illustrate that, of course, but I'm going to choose the path of my own history as a parent. One of the reasons that becoming a parent or having little kids around can be so hard is because of that kind of equation. The same thing with facing life with a health challenge or some other kind of reduction or change in capacity. The message is, I'll accept you and affirm that you have value as long as you're being productive. And if we absorb that message too deeply or too heedlessly, we can easily find ourselves on this kind of a treadmill where the corollary to that message is, if it's being productive that makes me valuable and that helps me to control my world, then being more productive should equal being more valuable and having more control over my world. To be clear, that's a lie. That's not true. But it's easy to see how we could fall into believing or acting as though it were, isn't it? And maybe this is why it comes as such a shock to the system when we encounter something like we've all been through the last couple of years, like a global pandemic, right smack in the middle of an era of arguably unparalleled productivity and agency or control. This shouldn't be happening. That phrase, that idea, this shouldn't be happening. That thought is often a way of not having to face a difficult thought like, maybe my narrative for how the world works is at best incomplete and possibly quite badly broken. Maybe it's kind of a dysfunctional narrative. Maybe it's not true. This shouldn't be happening is easier to process often than I might have the story wrong. I might need to adjust that. So, what happens if we start from a different place? I don't know if this will help you imagine the space that I'm working from, but just a reminder, I wrote all of this on Friday night, late at night, sitting beside my dying mom. Story adjustment, disruption, all part of my what's going on for me when I'm writing this, right? So, what happens if we start from a different place? What happens if we start with something more along the lines of, you and I, all humans, have value in the world simply because we exist as an unrepeatable expression, a unique iteration, an unparalleled outcome of the creative power of love. What happens if we start there? We exist in the world, we have value in the world simply because we exist as an unrepeatable expression of the creative power of love. If our worldview personifies love as God, then maybe we could use language like we have value in the world because we are a child of God, whom the rabbi Jesus described as love. There's the connection, okay? If we start there, I think it's a much shorter step to looking around at the rest of the living world, also an expression of that same mysterious reality, and seeing how much we have in common with that realm, rather than the realm of the machine world, of the mechanistic, of mass and motion. If we think of ourselves as part of a big machine, it's pretty easy to feel like we've been crushed when the machine stops working as it has in the past, or how we want it to or wish that it would. We're extremely vulnerable to that. But if we think of ourselves as something living rather than something mechanical, then we can shift other parts of the metaphor as well. For example, when it comes to what we might, you know, get done in a day or a week or a month in a lifetime, if we're thinking mechanistically and something happens that makes it hard to do what we previously did, even for a brief time, we might think in terms of ourselves being broken down, needing repair. In worst case scenarios, we might even think of ourselves as being in danger of being discarded or no longer useful or, you know, being replaced by a newer, more efficient model. But in a more organic way of thinking, productive can be replaced with ideas like fruitful. If we think of ourselves more like, as a starting point, more like a tree or like a garden, we can grow to understand that being fruitful is, among other things, something that comes in seasons. And also that it is something that comes as a result of our being tended, looked after, over a lifetime. There are lots of interesting and potentially healing outcomes from an idea shift like this. For example, most living things that bear fruit don't do it all the time. There are seasons of output and there are seasons of rest. There are seasons where there's a crop and there are seasons of fallowness. There is activity and there is rest. There is growth and there is dormancy, and that's not a problem. It's, in fact, it's good. It's right. When we encounter it in the rest of the living world, we don't question it. If we wish to see fruitfulness, in fact, what we do is we cooperate with it. And when we don't cooperate with it, we soon discover that there's a toll, that there's a cost. Even in climates that might permit it. In some ways, we live in a climate here in North America where fallowness is insisted upon by frost. You know, things don't grow because they're frozen solid. And so we see those rhythms all the time. But even in climates that might permit it, we can't constantly ask soil to grow things unless we want to force feed them with nutrients. And even then, we find out that we're in trouble with things like erosion. Because that's not the way reality is. We have so much agency that we can shove it in that direction, but it shoves back. It seems that even the dirt, which if you really want to get into it, a handful of dirt has all the same stuff in it that the rest of the universe does. Think about that for a minute. But as it turns out, even the dirt needs rest if it's going to be fruitful. And it's not resting so it will be fruitful, but it is being fruitful because it rests. They go together. The other metaphor, that you rest so you can be productive, that's tilting towards machine. You see what I'm saying? There's a bit of overlap there. Also, we don't have to consider this metaphor very deeply, I think, before we can recognize that fruitfulness, and we sort of touched on this, but to expand it a little bit, fruitfulness assumes nurturance. And often it assumes nurturance over a long period of time, over years, decades, generations. When something living is fruitful, it often points to care. We were driving out to Saskatoon the other day, most of us, in terms of our family, Crean's and my family, got to come along. Only Dasha was unable to come. So everybody else was in the van. It's a longish drive, 9 hours or so. And so lots of conversations were happening, as they do when we drive. And at one point, you know, we're in the middle of the prairies and we're talking about the sky and just the scale of this thing that we're looking at. And I said, like, the sky doesn't look that big if you just sort of look at it as a piece, the sky. But as soon as you go from the sky to the semi in front of you on the highway, it's like, oh, that's huge. And then we're kind of looking out at the prairies, which everyone in our family has some real affection for. We also love the mountains, but not in a way that denigrates our love for the prairies. And one of the things we love is that the sweep of it, and it's mid-August, you know, tilting into the last half of August, many of the crops are ripe, harvest was happening, some places we were driving along, beautiful time to drive across the prairies. And we were talking about at one point in the conversation about the decimation of the bison, North American bison, and kale, being the sort of person that they are, was looking up the numbers on their phone and talking about how over this very short period of time, this population of animals went from millions to 300 and some. It was decimated. And that got us talking about the nurturance of the land, of the prairies in particular, and about colonizers coming into that space where indigenous persons had been from before recorded history. And we were talking about, and I'm not using this as a technical term, just as an illustrative term. We were talking about indigenous farming. We were talking about the long, long, deliberate nurturance of the land. And of the reason that there are fruit trees in some parts of the prairies is because they were deliberately placed and cared for over many generations that they would be fruitful. Fruitfulness assumes, understands that it cannot be separate from nurturance. As we're starting to learn, I think, or maybe just recognize in some parts of the world, especially those parts that have been so enamored with mechanistic metaphors, we're starting to learn that fruitfulness points always to healthy interdependence. It points to the kind of things we might use words like community for. I mean, if we're talking literal trees, there's a technical term for this. We talked about it last week. The term is mycelial network. But since we're talking about humans, let's say community. Let's say relationships. A cog, you know, when one of my aging vehicles staggers, I can usually trace it back to a part. It can be isolated. That part can be manufactured somewhere else. It can be imported. It can be modified. It can be replaced. I can plug a new one in. And the machine will be productive again. A node in a living network, a mycelial network, not so much. We need one another, people. Period. And also, we need one another if we're going to thrive, if we're going to be fruitful. I heard somebody talking about this the other day and talking about how sort of having released themselves from operating under the weight of that mechanistic metaphor of the drive to be more productive and leaning into understanding themselves as a living being, part of a network, a living dynamic network of nurturance and care, actually found that in terms of getting things done, which we also need to do, they're life improved. Both the quality of their life improved and the meaningful outputs, the fruitfulness of their life improved. Interesting thing, you know. Lots of ways to illustrate it. Let me kind of wrap it up for today. This is not a screed against machines. My mom, who's just a few feet away from me, Is sleeping well enough tonight? In no small part because of machines. I'm glad for the support that they are providing. But I must say, that they are no substitute for Nurse Amy, who just came in to change my mom's position and make her more comfortable, and with whom I ended up having a very meaningful conversation about our respective families and what it feels like when someone is dying surrounded by love rather than discord or enmity. I think Amy's seen it all, you know. It was a good chat. Machines have their place, of course. But I'm not one. And you're not one. And the sooner we can start to consider the wonder of being the unique living outcomes of a great, powerful love, the sooner we can get on with thriving and being fruitful, or resting and being fallow, or nurturing someone else in whatever season they're in. None of these ideas are new. One of the reasons I love the context of this community is because of the traditions that many of us stand in. They carry ancient wisdom, and they'll carry it to us if we'll let them, you know. But it's there either way. And one of the things I love about the table is that this is not an exclusive. We don't live as a community in the presence of exclusive ancient wisdom. We actually live in the presence of for such a small community numerically, quite a rich collection. Three easily visible portions of which would be ancient Hebrew wisdom, ancient Judeo-Christian wisdom, and ancient indigenous wisdom. Those are all very present in our community ongoing, all the time. They're always getting mixed together. I want to reference an ancient Hebrew sage. It's kind of the last word on this. I sort of feel like this is a text that one of the Hebrew poets, one of the psalmists, in the first psalm in the collection in the Judeo-Christian scriptures, references right out of the chute. But I'll read you the text, and then I'm going to translate it a little differently for us and just say a couple of quick things about it. But I think the image is very rich and very powerful. I shall say this before I read the text. I've talked often in the last while about how when the ancient sages used phrases like "thus saith the Lord," or they referenced the Lord as or God as sort of a benchmark for reality, they were using that language because that's how they understood the way to reference mystery, the incontrovertible, can't change it as humans, reality. And so I've often used the phrase "thus saith reality" as a way of kind of talking about that. So keep that in mind when you listen to the first phrase of this text, and then kind of going forward, think about what we've been talking about. All right. So this is from the prophet Jeremiah, who is writing to a group of people who are displaced. They've been trampled by the military machine, and they're wondering why this is happening. Why are we suffering? And he doesn't have a lot to say to them. It's actually good news. Mostly what he has to say to them for 20-some chapters is, it's because you didn't cooperate with reality. But he names reality God, right? Okay, so you see that? See what I'm doing there? Whether you like it or not, I want it to be clear. So listen to this. So Jeremiah, "But blessed is the one who trusts in the Lord." So you can plug in reality there. Blessed is the one who trusts in, benchmarked by reality, whose confidence is in, so for Jeremiah, in him, a patriarchal deity, right? But you could say again, blessed is the one who trusts in reality and whose confidence is in reality. Because that person, Jeremiah says, will be like a tree, planted by the water, that sends out its roots by the stream. And in Jeremiah's geography, you can still travel there and see this tree, you know, quite literally, reaching its roots visibly, often because of the dry, loose nature of the soil, toward moisture. This person, whose confidence is in reality, they will be like a tree planted by the water that sends out its roots by the stream. And I love that the tree isn't gendered. It's just how it is with trees. Interesting thing in itself. It does not fear when heat comes. Its leaves are always green. that has no worries in a year of drought and never fails to bear fruit. Pretty lovely, eh? Short version is wherever you take your inspiration from, that seems like it'd be a good way to live. So I'm gonna lean into that and see how it goes. Grateful for the company. Thanks for choosing to be together this way in this moment. If you're a podcast listener and that's how you're joining us, thank you for making that choice. It's good to be with you in that way. And we'll gather again next week and see where exploring what we believe takes us. Peace.